Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest, Natasha Lyonne's Poker Face edition. It's Wednesday, February 1st, 2023. On today's show, Rian Johnson and Natasha Lyonne, he of Knives Out, she of Russian Doll, have teamed up to create Poker Face, a serial crime dramedy, kind of in the Columbo mode. We'll discuss. It's on Peacock. And then our march to the Oscars continues. We discuss All Quiet on the Western Front, which has been showered with nominations, nine in all, including Best Picture. It's a German language version of the classic novel detailing the brutalities of World War I. And finally, oh, capitalism, you've done it again. We discuss a Grub Street article about the latest stroke of capitalist genius for selling authenticity to yuppies, known as the Shoppy Shop. Joining me today is Julia Turner. She's the deputy managing editor of the LA Times. Hey, Julia.
Hello, hello, Steve.
Hello. And of course, Dana Stevens sitting across from me is the film critic for Slate. Though, Dana, I notice you're kind of two-timing a little bit on the cinema. You're writing about the television.
That's true. We'll talk about that this week. But this is the fallow season for movies is why. So, you know, I'm sort of stretching a little bit to write about some interesting and sometimes movie-related television projects.
Yeah, well, lucky us, right? The Poker Face piece was great. Let's start there. Rian Johnson has scored two huge hits with Knives Out and its sequel, Glass Onion. Natasha Lyonne, meanwhile, made really kind of an extraordinary comeback with the Netflix TV show Russian Doll a few years ago. The two have now teamed up for Poker Face on Peacock. It's kind of like an anti-premium streaming series in a way. It's not a bingeable set of 10 episodes that adds up to a single novelistic story arc, but it's really more of an old-fashioned case of the week TV show with a Columbo or, you know, even Murder, She Wrote vibe. Lyonne plays Charlie Kale, a casino employee with an astonishing gift. She can tell when people are lying, which she is now going to use now that she's on the lam to solve murders week by week. This is a scene from episode 3 where she catches someone telling a little white lie about paprika. Let's listen.
Paprika? Paprika? Yeah, it's just this stupid little thing that's been bugging me, because mostly when people lie, it's for some dumb who-cares reason, which I'm sure this is. So last night, in the kitchen, you said you didn't know where the paprika was, but you did know. So why were you lying about the paprika?
It was hectic. There was a lot going on, and I wanted Beto to find it.
To find it?
Look, Charlie, I like you. And if Taffy really is who you say he is, then, well, he must be very dangerous. For your own safety, I think your best move is to hit the road. Get a fresh start.
Something tells me she may not hit the road and get a fresh start in that episode. Dana, I loved your piece about this show. You seem to have connected with it. It's kind of great to have, I mean, Natasha Lyonne in anything, but to have her in her own distinctive, really wonderful way, channeling Peter Falk from the Columbo heyday. Pretty freaking great. What'd you make of it?
Yeah, I mean, this show just completely hit the spot for me. I'm not going to make any big argument for it as the future of television or, you know, anything that's kind of even reinventing the wheel as far as this crime of the week procedural goes. But we just don't have any shows like this right now. And I mean, as I think I've said at this point ad nauseum on this show, I just sometimes like get really over the episodic, deep mythology kind of TV that gives you a cliffhanger every single week. There's something really satisfying about individual episodes being tied up in a bundle, and you can watch them in any order, which you really can with this show. Once you've seen the pilot that, you know, sets out the premise that you just discussed, you really could just mix them up because it's just the same adventure happening over and over again. That makes it not the best show for binging because it is the same formula over and over again, but it does that in a very clever and sweet way. And just, you know, as with any of these shows, hangs on the personality of Natasha Lyonne. If you enjoy her, I mean, Russian Doll, the first season of it, was one of my favorite TV shows of the past, I don't know, 5-8 years. I absolutely loved that 6 episodes or whatever it was of TV. This isn't that. It's obviously a different structure, but it similarly relies on just the charm, the charisma, the rasping voice of Natasha Lyonne. So if you like her and you like a mystery of the week, retro-style Columbo story, I think you'll dig this show.
Yeah, and Julia, we hear that clip and, like, immediately my tail starts wagging. Like, I just love the sound of Natasha Lyonne's voice, especially recently, that like, experience weathered, you know, rasp. It's, like, so human and easy to connect with. What do you make of this one?
I mean, let me mount an argument that this is revolutionizing the future of TV. I'm not sure I believe it, but let me try. Why has it taken this long in the peak TV fancy streaming era for really creative people who are capable of our best work to just take aim at the procedural? The procedural is such a fun format. It's so satisfying. It's television's ultimate comfort food. I say this as someone who I think has literally watched every single episode ever aired of both Law & Order and Law & Order SVU. Like, and we don't spend a ton of time talking about shows like that because the pleasures of them are not, it's not Andor, it's not The Last of Us, it's not trying to make a huge point about humankind, it's not trying to make you think differently about the world, it's not really even trying to make art, it's trying to use the tools of art to please you and entertain you. Mm-hmm. And somehow it's so refreshing to have these, not just talented, but like, I don't know, kind of chic artists, right? Like kind of cool artists. They're both at these career peaks, right? Like Natasha Lyonne has made just this incredible stuff. Rian Johnson has shown that he can like tangle with the Star Wars verse, come out more successful than he was before, and then turn his attention to like making adults love murder mysteries again. Like, what a gift for these people to decide that at this moment of peak talent, when what they could say is, we really want to recreate All Quiet on the Western Front with Natasha as Paul, like, they could do that if they wanted, but they don't. They just want to have fun. Mm-hmm. It's so pleasant. It's so pleasant. And I think there's, like, plenty to dissect tonally in the show and why the tone is so pleasant right now and how we should feel about that, but I'm ready for the procedural wave. Like, let's start casting. I want all my favorite actors to pair up with all my favorite director creators and make more procedurals. Like, yes, this sounds great. This is delightful.
Right. And there was something about, I mean, Julia, I know you've said this many times, that this, the sonnet gives rise to creativity for being a shackle. Right? It just girdles the form so tightly as if you obey its fundamental rules. And there's something to be said for something that's miniaturized and yet delivers on the familiar rhythm something new and interesting. And I think this show does all of the above. Plus, it has Natasha Lyonne and that voice and that charisma, that quiet, smoky charisma that's just hers alone at this point. So it's, I think it's very successfully delivered. I think there's something very briefly to be said about, like, let's not lose the virtues of the streaming thing, the kind of peak TV, golden age TV, streaming TV. Think of this briefly just as a business story, right? Standalone TV was totally necessary because you had to catch an episode when it was aired. You couldn't count on everyone seeing every episode. You couldn't really follow multi-episode arcs. It wouldn't have worked in the pre-streaming era. And secondly, syndication, right, was where tons and tons and tons of money was made on the back end of these shows if they achieved a certain, you know, critical mass popularity-wise. And they were just, you could pop them out, you could catch one and then never watch it again, or catch a couple and it didn't matter what order you were seeing them in. I feel like I'm going to the hardware store for oranges, as they say, in a weird way. Like, I feel Peacock, being an NBC product, kind of wants to have familiarity, old shoe familiarity to it, to draw in like a new demographic of watchers. At the same time, it wants the prestige of prestige TV. And there were moments where I was like, hey, is this all going to fit together? I liked it, but I'm not sure I'm going to return to it over and over and over again.
I don't know. I guess they're just betting on the fact, Peacock is just betting on the fact that, as Julia was saying, the kind of prestige right now and the hipness of the combination of Leone and Johnson will draw people in. I don't personally watch TV in order to sustain some sort of, you know, narrative underneath the episodes. In other words, it didn't feel like a fault in these episodes that it didn't supply that and didn't make me want to watch them less. In fact, I think this is very well suited to the weekly drop because, like I was saying, it's not a show you really want to binge. I did binge it in order to review it. And while I liked many of the episodes, actually, number 5 is my favorite. And I want to put that out there. If you aren't liking the show, try number 5 just on its own. It happens to co-star as one of its Love Boat Guest of the Week cameos, a Law & Order veteran, S. Patha Merkerson, and also has Judith Light. It's a really great episode. I don't know. I don't really have an answer to that business question, but I feel like the show has been very warmly critically received, and I have a feeling audiences will mainly respond to it
right.
as well.
I just want to refine that a tiny bit, Julia. I only meant that I'm out of certain viewing habits and not sure how quickly I'm going to reacclimate myself to them. Law & Order was, it just came back from a restaurant, 11 p.m. rolls around or midnight, and I've just watched The Daily Show, and boom, there's Law & Order. It's just old reliable. Like, I just kind of don't want to go to bed. I'll watch it, whatever. Yeah, that made sense. It didn't have to be a great show. It had to be familiar, comforting, you know, it had those rhythms or whatever. And I'm not so sure that I would seek out in a streaming context this particular, I don't feel the itch and I won't go in search of the scratch.
I mean, I don't know. As someone who definitely feels the itch on a regular basis, I don't know how to relate to that. You do you. But I will say, to me, one of the things that has a lot to recommend it about this show and that is so fun and feels like such a gift is that it's not just that you have this cast of extraordinary actors showing up and really delivering in these little bit roles that get discarded episode by episode, but they're really well written and crafted and drawn. Mm. Like, as someone who has seen, 67,000 episodes of Law & Order, when you go and meet the bartender or the babysitter or the landlord or the garbage truck guy or, you know, all of the different characters you meet as the mystery gets unraveled, they're fine. They're sort of disposable performances. Sometimes they're great. Sometimes they're freakishly bad. It's kind of funny to track them. They're really, because you're producing 20 to 24 a year in the classic broadcast mode, you take an approach to the scripts that befits that economic structure, right? Whereas here, in part because of the kind of caliber of the cast and the fact that they're like having a lark doing this fun procedural, and in part because of the setup of the show where she is a personality susser who can tell when people are lying, and because of the Columbo structure where you know who did it and it's just a question of how is it going to get figured out or revealed, all of that requires like a little bit of a closer character study of all the people involved in every drama. And so, all of these performances give you a lot to watch. Like, it isn't really just, the kind of endless stream of like dead body, mad landlord. Oh God, it was the aunt. There was a will, dead body, mad lawyer. Oh God, there was a corporate struggle. It was the CEO, it's not.
No, true.
The textures of it are really rewarding. And, that is, I wonder if this show will endure because the, or if, you know, if they'll even keep doing it just because the particulars of the way in which Natasha Lyonne is charming. I love her wardrobe. She's dressed kind of like a Muppet at Burning Man most of the time, like a lower key Burning Man. I guess she's not wearing like steampunk goggles, but she just looks like a desert freak in a great way. I also don't know, since she's on The Lamb, why she keeps putting on new outfits. I find that confusing. But the pleasures of it feel very of the moment. Like, a lot going on in the world, lot to think about. Let's just put all of our love and care and craft on something a little insular and fun.
I mean, I will just say that I personally hope it gets a second season. I suspect it will at least get a second season. Mm-hmm. And I also think that actors are going to be clawing to the top of the pile to appear on this. Because you're right, Julia. It's not, you know, the reason we laugh at guest spots on Law & Order because it's sort of like, look, Philip Seymour Hoffman playing, you know, whatever, random delinquent number three. Whereas here, every guest star gets a real chance to, you know, to do something, to sink their teeth into an interesting role. And again, Merkerson in episode 5, I love her. So, yeah. Please bring us another season.
It's Poker Face. It's on Peacock. Check it out. We all really liked it. Let's move on.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on all your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
Okay, before we go any further, this is typically where we discuss business. Dana, I'm sure you have some there. What do you got?
Stephen, our first item of business this week is just to tell you that we're still accepting applications for the role of our production assistant. We're hiring a new one, if you didn't hear our announcement last week. This person will help us come up with ideas for the show. They join our planning call every week, and they put together a research packet ahead of our recording so we know something about the topics we're talking about. This is a really important role to us, so we want to find the right person. It's been filled by some really talented people in the past who have gone on to very interesting jobs in journalism and elsewhere. This job requires a time commitment of about 10 to 12 hours a week. The starting wage is $20 an hour or possibly more based on your experience. And we are based in New York City, so we would love to hire someone who we can occasionally see in person in the studio, but remote candidates will also be considered. If you want to apply to be our production assistant, please send us a cover letter explaining why you want the job. And please also include two topics that you'd like to hear us discuss on a future episode. You can send this cover letter to culturegabfestassistant@gmail.com. Once again, that's culturegabfestassistant@gmail.com. We'll make sure to post that email address on our show page as well. And our second item of business, as always, is just to tell you about today's Slate Plus segment. This week, we're going to talk about sleepovers. There have been a couple of buzzy articles lately arguing about sleepovers for kids and their value, one in the Washington Post and one in the Atlantic, one pro and one con. The Washington Post one talks about the possible risks of sleepovers and things that could go wrong, might be dangerous about them, while the Atlantic piece basically defends them and argues that they're a crucial part of growing up. We talked about this a bit on our planning call this week and decided that we had enough to say about it. There was enough juice there to have our own little argument or at least discussion about sleepovers. So that will be our Slate Plus segment for this week. So if you're a Slate Plus member, stick around for that conversation at the end of today's show. And if you're not a Slate Plus member, you can sign up today at slate.com/culture plus. When you're a member, you get ad-free podcasts, you get bonus content like the segment I just described, and you'll get unlimited access to all of the great writing on Slate. You'll never hit a paywall when you belong to Slate Plus. And of course, you will be supporting our work and the work of our brilliant colleagues. These memberships are really important for Slate. So please sign up today at slate.com/culture plus. Once again, that's slate.com/culture plus. Okay, Steve, what's next?
All right, well, the German director Edward Berger has taken on a monumental task, as anyone approaching this classic novel, All Quiet on the Western Front, would have to. He the challenge, I think, in doing this material again is to depict the First World War, a half-forgotten war, a war without all of the greatest generation mythologies of defeating fascism and therefore evil, in all of its gruesome, ignoble majesty, while also making us care. It's a very remote from our lived experience. To do so, and keying off of the original novel, Berger's movie follows Paul Baumer, a 17-year-old boy filled with jingoistic zeal and all the courage and naivete, therefore, of youth, from his enlistment through the utter pointless brutality of the trenches as it adds up to absolutely nothing. Okay, well, we face this challenge occasionally when we do a foreign language movie. We don't have an obvious clip to use. This movie is almost entirely in German. So we don't have any dialogue, but there are so many interesting sonic moments in this movie. This is from a haunting early scene where we see women repairing the uniforms of dead soldiers so they can be recycled for new recruits who themselves are just products of recycling. So you're going to hear the sewing machines in this clip and also the abrasive score that recurs throughout the film. Let's have a listen. Julia, let me do something slightly different. It's a movie, but I'll start with you because we started with Dana last time. You know, have I framed this wrong? I mean, World War I is the most important thing that never happened to us, right? It's outside of living memory, and yet it is arguably the greatest folly in human history. It killed 17 million people for really nothing. And yet, law of unintended consequences, it kind of gave us modern life. It gave us the 20th century as we know it, and therefore the world in which we live. Berger had a real challenge here. How do you think he rose to it?
This movie is really hard to not watch. It's weird. I mean, I think part of why we're doing this movie this week, we should note, is that it came in with 9 Oscar nominations, Best Picture, Best International Picture, all of the technical awards, including score for that amazing sound, World War I at the club. And I can, you know, so we were like, great, all right, let's dig in. Basically, all of Hollywood was sort of like, huh, wow, okay. Everyone's been talking about Banshees. Everyone's been talking about Everything Everywhere All at Once, the other two top nomination getters. And then this, you know, German language Netflix film full of like bleak trench shit when we just had a bleak trench shit movie, you know, a couple of years ago with 1917. I don't know. I was not looking forward to it, and it was a grueling watch, but it's a weirdly beautiful and watchable movie. Like I sort of understood upon watching it why it has a nomination in every single technical category. The way in which often wordlessly, often just as you're watching soldiers tumble through incredibly bleak, purposeless tasks. It creates little moments of drama and suspense and drive, and it carries your attention through pretty briskly for a movie that's 2 hours and 27 minutes long. I was really impressed by this movie's technical skill. So in terms of pure craft, I thought it was great. In terms of its purpose in revisiting it now, I was curious to think through what it would mean, what it might mean in modern Germany at this moment to revisit this story. Because, you know, I mean, there is a incredibly stupid war going on right now in Europe. And of course, this movie must have been conceived and made well before Putin invaded Ukraine. But I don't know. I also had never seen either of the other adaptations, nor have I read the book. So I also didn't know how the story ended, which I won't divulge here. But I had the perhaps amusing experience of being surprised by this age-old text. But I'm so curious to hear what you guys thought of it.
Yeah, Dana, as Julia says, nominated to the skies every major category, do you think deservedly? What'd you make of it?
I mean, I agree with Julia that on a craft level, it really is extraordinary. It made me wish that I had seen it in a theater because it really is a big screen spectacle that does a lot of starkly beautiful, you know, ironically beautiful things with the equipment of war. You know, there's a recurring image of, I guess it's just is a bomb dropping from a plane, right? But there's this sort of almost comet-like light in the sky that the soldiers look up and witness from the trenches. And it's all shot in this very beautiful way that yet doesn't seem aestheticized. I don't know if you guys saw 1917, the Sam Mendes film from 2019, but that was my main critique of 1917. It is also a kind of miracle of craft. And I think I said this in my review of 1917, but as beautifully done as it was on a technical level, it felt a little bit like a video game in a way that felt sort of unethical, you know, that felt somehow wrong. And this movie doesn't have that fault. It manages to, you know, create this sort of beautiful spectacle of war without it being beautified and with it being fully, you know, cognizant of the ugliness of war. In fact, obsessed with showing us that ugliness over and over again. But there were some things about it that deviate from the novel and also from the 1930, you know, Best Picture winning early sound adaptation of the novel that I don't think really belonged there. And they were a pretty major part of the movie. And that is the cutting back to the diplomats and the generals and the guys in boardrooms that are trying to negotiate the armistice as we see the young men fighting out in the trenches. And I'm not sure that, although that all seemed exquisitely well researched, and as my viewing companion observed, it was like the weft and weave of the fabrics of everyone's uniforms seemed like it had just been researched to the nines. And, you know, it was from a point of view of production design and, you know, just historical detail was extraordinary. But I didn't think that added dramatically very much to the movie at all. For one thing, those characters were not real characters, like guy with a bushy mustache, you know, shaking his fist in a boardroom about war. We didn't know who they were. And they just represented an ideology, essentially, the ideology of, you know, war for war's sake and kind of the inability to negotiate peace. And I don't know, I guess I just felt that contrast was really obvious and we know, we get it. You know, we get that there is a vast distance between the guys that are drinking fine wines in a train car somewhere arguing about the war and the boys in the trenches. And I just kind of wanted to stay with the boys in the trenches.
Right. I concur completely. I thought that worked least well in the movie. What I thought worked. It's a bravura piece of cinema making, and it deserves its nomination. Julia, I had exactly the same response before I pressed play. I thought, not really sure, other than the nominations, why I would be interested in this. And within 30 seconds, I was riveted and riveted pretty much to the end. I thought what worked absolutely best within all, I mean, other than the just sheer movie making virtuosity of it, was the camaraderie of this small cohort of, I think they're classmates, who are serving together, at the center of which is Paul. But then he develops a friendship with someone who wasn't, who's a little older and is in fact working class and illiterate named Kat. His nickname is Kat. I thought that performance was wonderful. I thought their friendship was wonderful. It's the most meaningful part of the movie in some sense. And their twinned fate is what I cared about most deeply. One thing I would say is that, and this is a point it turns out Jamel Bowie made really well, and I had read this when I was in like seventh grade, and there was one thing I remembered about the whole book, which was that central to it, and central to its point, is how at those moments where he takes leave from the front and goes home, he finds himself completely alienated from his own family, his own teachers, that it wasn't the discrepancy between a leadership class, which is not depicted in the novel. None of that is from the original book. But the discrepancy between the person who actually experiences the trenches and the entire rest of German society, which is still talking in the same pieties that got everyone into the mess in the first place. And it just... And that is a central experience of modernity. It creates, you could argue, modern art and modern literature, the total obliterating of piety and a certain kind of received highfalutin language in Victorian diction by experience, specifically the experience of the trenches. And that's missing from this. You never see him return to civilian life. And Dana, I kept thinking an anti-war movie, I mean, this is considered to be the greatest anti-war text of all time, or certainly one of them. But an anti-war movie needs a war. And our sense of what an anti-war movie is got completely remade by the Vietnam War, because Vietnam remade our sense of what war is. War is different in some ways now than it was then. And so the central force of this initial document doesn't really have much of a place in here. You could certainly interpret it in light of the Ukrainian war. It should certainly expand your sympathies for the people who, I'm sure, fighting the war, those people are sick of the pieties behind it on both sides. But that was too abstract, too, given the brutality of the film. I don't know. I wasn't sure always why I was watching it other than the power of the filmmaking.
Yeah, I mean, I think my critique of this movie, if I had to have one overarching one, would be why this movie now, you know, and what does it have to say or bring to the war genre that's new? I mean, as you say, the novel this is based on by Eric Marie Remarque was, I mean, not only an extremely successful novel at the time, right, but mm-hmm. it was a really important novel in literary history because it was, in a way, one of the first war memoirs. I mean, it's a fictionalized version, but yeah. He was a veteran of World War I. And the whole genre of, you know, writing about one's actual experience in the war, which is almost always going to be an anti-war text, right? Because
yes.
Who is coming back with a story that's inspirational from that experience, right, was begun by this. So I guess if you're German, there's an answer to that question that I can't really grasp as an American viewer, which is that this is a German language text about a German war, right, from the century in which there were these two, you know, vastly destructive wars that began because of choices that country's leadership made. And so this must, and it's the first German language adaptation of that novel. So this has to land very differently there. From some of the research we did, it seems like not every critic there has loved the movie, and that some of them on ideological grounds have objected to, you know, the way it presents the war. So maybe we're not the right people to answer that question. I think that would be, if this were to win a bunch of Oscars, I think that would be my one qualm about it. Not that it's not a deserving film, not that it's not made with, you know, care and love and a lot of attention to detail and to good storytelling. But what does this movie have to bring to us now that we haven't already seen, you know, for decades and decades in anti-war films?
Yeah, Dana, the question of why now is so interesting to me, and I felt myself wanting to understand the German politics. I was struck by the argument that, you know, instead of zooming out to see how alienated he is from home and what even matters, what the political machinations are, we spend the time with these poignant bureaucrats. I wonder if it has something to do with the futility, like the actual inability to accomplish anything that is striking. Like, I feel like the Vietnam narrative is like, we're all doing all this stuff and it's so stupid and pointless, but you can denude the jungle and use, you know, like the action of Vietnam movies is not itself nihilistic, right? Like, they do stuff over there. It's just all for no reason. Whereas the actual futility of trench warfare and the combat itself being so purposeless, like, is that what's resonating with us now? Help me out. Why are we looking back at this war right now?
Let me hazard an answer, Julia, as best I can, which is that, you know, unintentionally, this movie gives us some kind of an explanation for the, to put it mildly, equivocal response of the Germans to the Ukrainian war. Their reluctance to step in, to supply arms or financial support to the degree the other NATO, major NATO allies are. Its relative reticence in condemning Putin. I think it has to do with way more than just a dependency on the fossil fuels of Russia. I think this movie helps explain why, after two brutal world wars and sort of century-defining world wars, both lost by Germany, there's a streak of anti-piety and anti-charisma that runs through, especially the reunited Germany, that conduces to a degree of pacifism that I think you feel when you go there. The entire country is devoted, in some sense, to reckoning and historical memory and not repeating the mistakes of the past. And so, of course, it couldn't have been in response to the Ukrainian war, but it's out of the same zeitgeist that gives us this, I think in some ways, quite frustrating reluctance in the face of the Ukrainian conflict to take clear sides and repeat pieties that I regard to be true, that we're fighting global, essentially on our behalf. Zelensky and the Ukrainians are fighting global illiberalism in ways that are utterly heroic. But it is so, this movie, if nothing else, is a reminder that it is so fucking easy for me to sit here and say that, that at the actual level of boots on the ground, exactly these experiences or their equivalents are happening every single day. And I don't have to experience that terror. And so to the extent that one remakes a movie like this, maybe it should be remade every 10 years. It's a salutary reminder. Some other often young and increasingly in the modern world, socially and financially disenfranchised person acts as our surrogate.
Yeah, maybe every generation needs this movie again, right? I mean, and it's worthy of noting in that context that the book was banned by the Nazis, Erich Maria Remarque's novel.
And burnt,
so reading it now in Germany, which I gather all students do, you know, as many students do here in the U.S., is a way of reclaiming a history that was lost.
Okay, the movie is All Quiet on the Western Front. It's on Netflix. It is very easy to see and I think really worth seeking out. Okay, let's move on.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Hey, listeners, whether you love true crime or comedies, celebrity interviews, news, or even motivational speakers, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue, right? And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance, too. Enter the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. The Name Your Price tool puts you in charge of your auto insurance by working just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance. Then they'll show you a variety of coverages that fit within your budget, giving you options. Now, that's something you'll want to press play on. It's easy to start a quote, and you'll be able to choose the best option for you fast. It's just one of the many ways you can save with Progressive Insurance. Quote today at progressive.com to try the Name Your Price tool for yourself and join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queens say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.
All right, well, the author Emily Sundberg has written a piece for Grub Street that really caught our eye. It's about a phenomenon dubbed shoppy shops. And let me quote someone that she quotes because it captures it really well. We need a new term for, quote, internet-based small businesses that still use global supply infrastructure, as Sundberg says. This is a friend of hers speaking, a culture writer, who also tells Emily Sundberg, we know these minimalist-ish generic aesthetics are not connected to any true local origin, but we see them as indicative of some kind of authenticity. My current thought is that they don't feel local to a place, but instead they feel local to the internet, which is, after all, where we all live. And someone else in the course of the piece dubs these shoppy shops. Julia, what'd you make of both the piece and the phenomenon it's describing?
Oh, it's so satisfying when a piece of culture reporting puts its finger on something you've observed in the world and haven't even quite noticed yourself noticing. It's one of my favorite types of reporting, and this piece is a real coup of that, of sort of noting that more and more at the little coffee shop or the plant store or the, you know, place that you do still go to in a bricks and mortar sense, the same sets of things show up, particular soaps, particular tinned fish, particular attractively designed but available everywhere, but designed as though they aren't available everywhere, bottles of olive oil. And what the piece reveals is that there is this kind of internet back end for people who want to put beautiful little dry goods in their stores. The piece notes that a lot of people use the word provisions, so that essentially they can go on a big online database and click up on a wholesaler's version of Amazon, the things that they can put in their mom and pop shops to keep you from feeling like you just buy things at Amazon. And it's so, I'm not sure that that reveal is actually shocking. Like, you know, I don't know how we think the purveyors of little shops found the cute things in their stores before. Did they all go actually like forage them in the bushes of local craftsmen? Maybe, but you know, that like wholesaling has always been a business. But I think it's such a smart piece about the aesthetics of consumption and what we want to feel when we're buying something and how, you know, capitalism is always a step ahead of us in figuring out how to offer us consumer experiences that are the ones we want to have at any given moment. What did you guys make of this piece? Do you live in the land of the shoppy shops? Many of the shoppy shops are described are Brooklyn shoppy shops. Did this hatch a ping of recognition for you guys?
I think it did less for me for the very dorky reason that I do almost all my food shopping at the food co-op, which Steve just recently became a member of too. And after I put in that, you know, whatever it is, 3 hours of work every 6 weeks, I'm damn well going to shop there and get some value from it. So I don't think I wander into the places that have these kind of small washed, as the piece says, you know, these items that are made to look as if they come from small businesses when they're actually part of some big supply chain. I mean, the packaging that she describes, I recognize perfectly. And it's a really lively piece to read for that reason, just the way she describes, you know, the look of these objects. You know, you certainly see them everywhere. And, you know, the sudden wave for tinned fish that swept the nation in the last couple, I don't know, years or so, she kind of puts her finger on the trendiness of those kinds of things, you know, those items that a desire is sort of created artificially for them on the internet, which I do completely recognize, even if I'm probably not wandering into the shops that sell them.
Yeah, I mean, so a couple different things. First of all, just chapeau, right? Like the capitalism's ability to satisfy what feel like deep needs, but in fact are themselves only cravings produced by capitalism is just endlessly innovative. And one of the, you know, sides of the street that it's been working for at least the last 20, 30 years is authenticity. As someone who moved to a very small community filled with small producers, I think there is a genuine version of this, and I don't think we should go so Warhol and Pomo that we think everything is always branding, therefore plus ça change. I hate that argument. I just don't think it's real. I think some things produced at a more handcrafted level are in some obvious way better. I mean, as someone who personally knows people who started incredibly popular, successful businesses at a micro scale, right? Like the Suarez Brewery up where I live, like, they have decided not to grow. They can't make what they make at scale. They can get by and do well, but not get rich at the level that they're at currently. And they, as of now at least, you know, refuse to go to the next level. And so I think, yeah, Julia, I guess I would throw it back and just say, listen, I have no problem. Certain things probably are produced so much more efficiently at scale and with no appreciable loss of quality. You know, to the extent that there's any justice in this way of doing things, it's the radically lowered cost of goods and therefore their accessibility to a much... There is an economic democracy behind production at scale in a way. So, you know, that's a freedom I think we should revel in and take advantage of where appropriate. But then don't fake it. Like, don't play me like a sucker, because then I will backlash against it. And secondly, don't tell me this lie that in some instances there's no difference between, you know, Budweiser and like the microbrewery, you know, the farm microbrewery in Vermont that blah, 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 like fill in the blank. I don't know.
You're right. I should not be quite so cynical about it. In sniffing a bit at the reveal that there is a like place where shop owners can go to find what goods are available wholesale, like there have been some centralized places for that. But the other, you're right that the other thing this piece highlights, and that's part of what makes it such an interesting, sticky, good piece of journalism, is that there's a couple of interesting trends captured in it, is sort of pretty big businesses pretending to be small businesses in the, through their aesthetics, right? And sort of trying to grow but retain the feeling of like the direct-to-consumer relationship and the aesthetics of like, oh, I just happened to find this beautiful little company that makes these sweet little tin fish with the pretty picture on the front. The other trend that this piece touches on, and again, it's just like a really dense morsel that you should go read, is the idea that a lot of us are now getting pushed products on Instagram and other social platforms, and there's a certain kind of vertigo of encountering those direct-to-consumer brands without the stamp of approval of a local seller or curator or somebody you trust saying the thing is actually good. Like, I feel like I have this all the time. I'll see like a swimsuit or a skirt or whatever and just be like, is this real? Like, is this a real company that makes real stuff that I might really want? Or is this like a dumb Instagram charade where the shirt's going to be made out of cardboard or the whole thing is just a scam to like get me to pay money for a brand I have no relationship or trust in?
I mean, I guess there's something to be said for just the existence of brick and mortar stores continuing, right? It kind of goes to the argument we're always having about theatrical screenings of movies versus watching them digitally. We would all be sad if movie theaters didn't exist anymore, even if we don't go to them as much as we used to. And it's the same thing with stores. I'd rather walk into a small washed store and buy some cute cliched products that I can, as you say, Julia, at least hold and kind of experience and assume that somebody has filtered in some way, than, you know, order a dress off Instagram, as I have stupidly done before, and then have it arrive as this flimsy thing that's more of a see-through shirt that you're never going to actually don.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing. Like, maybe this is good news, right? Like, wouldn't you rather have a dozen shoppy shops in your neighborhood than a dozen, like, ATM machines, which was the prior highest and best use discovered by capitalism of, like, Brooklyn real estate, right? Like, so what if they all sell one particular brand of internet olive oil? Like, I don't know. That's kind of cute. That seems like more fun to walk past than the ATM.
Wait a second, though.
And wait. Just let me finish. Like, I guess if like what the machine of venture capitalism has discovered is that people want to go to stores near them to buy things, like, that's good. Like, I'm happy for that. That feels like progress in the, like, never mind, stores be dead, you'll buy it all on Amazon, the food will come in the tube from the sky. Like, it seems like humanity prevailing in some fashion.
Okay, so you're laying out three choices: Amazon, the giant tube in the sky, ATMs, or shoppy shops. Those are not the choices. The choices are rents that aren't out of control, so actual mom and pop operations can open up in neighborhoods, and the money doesn't flow to a bunch of private equity dickheads. It's actually going to the people who used their highly specific creative energies and daring do as actual entrepreneurs, not fake balance sheet entrepreneurs, looking for a quick buck to make something that might actually turn into a lasting local institution, right? Like, I think people move to New York City because of more for like things that are part of the deep fabric of a community, not some shoppy shop that's a pop-up designed to make some, you know, the latest iteration of the financial, you know, jerk rich. Anyway.
Well, when you put it that way, I start to Steve's winning me over. I'm thinking of Blank Street Coffee, which this article doesn't mention, but which is this scourge that's popped up
terrible.
All around New York.
It's like awful coffee.
A fake small business. I haven't had it. I've not
it's
walked into one. But
coffee. Right? That's the freaking problem.
But that's the example of a VC startup that is really kind of, I don't know, just homogenizing neighborhoods.
And fine, people don't know the difference. But, enjoy it.
But the venture capitalists in this story don't own the shops. The venture capitalists own some of the brands available in the shops and the back end that the shopkeepers can use to put cute provisions next to the coffee counter in their shops.
Yeah, spoiler alert, the next thing they're going to do is buy these frickin' things, the shoppy shops themselves.
But it's a little bit more complicated than that.
All right, this is one of those ones we'll throw to you guys. Just email us what you think about shoppy shops. And also, who's right, me or Julia? Welcome to the Shoppy Shop is the article. It's in Grub Street, and it's by Emily Sundberg. Let's move on. All right, now is the moment in our podcast when we endorse. Dana, what do you have this week?
I feel like my endorsements are increasingly coming from my thespian child who consumes so much interesting culture and is always sending me to interesting things now. And this week, I'm inspired by her to refer everyone to an hour-long TV documentary called Kiss Me, Petruchio from 1981. It is the story of, it's the backstage documentary about Meryl Streep and Raul Julia doing Taming of the Shrew in Shakespeare in the Park in 1981. So, you know, there was just somebody following them around as they were getting their costumes fitted and learning their lines and getting the show together. I believe you can also watch a filmed version of their version of Taming of the Shrew, but this is more the making of. It's just an hour long, and it's just so much fun to watch young Meryl Streep and young Raul Julia, you know, direct to camera talking about their interpretation of this play. They talk about the feminist problems with the play, because, of course, Taming of the Shrew is all about, you know, essentially how Petruchio has to abuse his wife to get her to obey, and Meryl Streep has some very interesting stuff to say about that. But mainly, I mean, if you're just a theater nerd and you want to see things like close-ups on the costume makers sewing the flowers onto the dress, I mean, it's such a juicy theater nerd watch. So it's called Kiss Me, Petruchio. It is all over the place. I believe that she found it on Amazon. It might be on Netflix as well, but I think if you Google it, you'll have no trouble finding it. Kiss Me, Petruchio from 1981.
That sounds amazing. Oh, man. All right, yeah. Julia, what do you have?
Okay, well, I know we just talked about The Last of Us a couple weeks ago. I had not yet seen the third episode. And as if you're following on Twitter or following the TV cultureverse at all, you will have heard that the third episode of The Last of Us is an absolute stunner of a love story. It sort of departs from our main characters and depicts the world of two men played by Nick Offerman and Murray Bartlett and how they navigate this post-apocalyptic landscape and eventually intersect with our main characters. And it's just an incredibly beautiful love story that's incredibly well acted and made me feel 100% on board the rest of this show and wherever it's going to take us, even if the rest of it is literally just like pop-up zombies for seven more episodes. Like, I have to watch the rest of the show to see what it does. It just, if you have not joined this journey, you've got to go do it. And my favorite tweet about this that went viral on Sunday night after it aired was from a tweeter who goes by Zach Silverberg, who wrote, "The Last of Us writers were like, hey, Joel needs a car. What if we write the most touching and heartbreaking hour of television in the world?" Which is basically the plot of the episode. So, yeah, if you were not convinced by last week's conversation to get on board The Last of Us train and you are alarmed by the zombie talk, at least watch the first three episodes, because this third episode is a must-see.
Oh, man. Yeah, no, I missed that episode of our show due to COVID, so I haven't seen Last of Us yet, so now I'm all in. Thanks for that, Julia. All right, so I couldn't let the death of Tom Verlaine go unremarked. To the extent Verlaine had a unfortunate fate as a musician, it was only that he came up next to the Talking Heads, his band Television, came up right next to. He was peer band to Talking Heads, Ramones, Blondie, you know, just all of whom went on to much, much bigger success than Verlaine's band Television. But, you know, I would say the critical consensus is not only every bit as good, but, you know, Marquee Moon is the perfect rock and roll record. It's one of the best rock albums ever made. Verlaine just died, I think, about the age of 73. And his music was so hard to class in a way because it was obviously it had this punk aura to it. It's clearly they were a CBGB's band in some ways all the way. But at the same time, his and his Richard Lloyd, the other guitarist, these beautiful, almost Bach-like guitar duets, basically harmonized or counterpointed, sometimes one, sometimes the other, guitar lines interspersed in the songs were just intricate, really haunting, very musical for a punk band. Just rest in peace, Tom Verlaine. I mean, really created one of the great, great bands of all time. The albums Adventure and Marquee Moon are both absolute stone-cold masterpieces. And then super quickly, a discovery. Skeeter Davis, anybody? Pop country icon, really, sort of pop music country icon from, I'm going to say, 40s, 50s, 60s, maybe. I mean, 50s, 60s, probably. Love Skeeter Davis, it turns out. Sort of half forgotten, maybe too poppy for country, too country for pop. And she made one song with her sister, at least one song with her sisters under the name The Davis Sisters. I forgot more than you'll ever know about him.
Than you ever know about him.
Which is such a great song. Oh my God, check it out. You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page. That's slate.com/culturefest. And you can email us if we love it at culturefest@slate.com. Our introductory music is by the composer Nicholas Britell. Our production assistant is Jessica Balderrama. Our producer is Cameron Drews. For Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, I'm Stephen Metcalf. Thank you so much for joining us. We will see you soon.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queens say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.